ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National. A show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
Hello there.
Or should I say Ramadan Mubarak, as we move into one of the great Mindfield traditions, I think. Welcome to the Mindfield, where we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. We often get stuck into the world, and now we commence a period where we quite deliberately and conspicuously retreat from it. We stop reading the Times and turn instead to the eternities. Listeners should know who I'm quoting there. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed. We were having a little debate off air with our producer last week about exactly what year of the Ramadan series
this is.
I think it's either 7 or 8, with maybe one break in the middle where we didn't have a series as much as we had a single episode because of the pandemic. But
This is where I'm very confused. I thought it was 9 or 10, with the possibility of one of them being broken. Because the pandemic year, we did one episode, didn't we?
We did. We did. Just a single one.
And then the pandemic rudely got in the way.
It was
most unfortunate. Not that that was the main effect of the pandemic, I hasten to add.
No. Inconvenience was the least of the things that was going on.
I also seem to recall, was there one year we kind of did a Ramadan series by accident? We may not have named it as such or something like that. Anyway, this all gets very complicated.
That was actually our first.
It might have been, right?
Yeah.
So I'm sure historians will debate this for a very long time. I've no doubt about that. But here we are this year on the cusp of another month. It's one of the, I would say, more rewarding but also most difficult elements of our Mindfield year, is trying to figure out what we're going to do here. And I have to confess, when you came to me with this particular idea, I was thrilled at it. I didn't know exactly what it would look like. To be honest, as I'm sitting here right now, I still don't. But the concept is one of those ones that it could hardly be more appropriate to the idea of this series, and it could hardly be more vital to, to use a Mindfieldism, questions of the moral life. And yet it's something that we almost never talk about in public discourse, for reasons that I suppose we can get into. But it's worth noting that if this sounds strange over the course of the next 4 weeks, then that is telling, and I would say a problem.
Nicely said. Can I put just a slightly different twist on it?
Sure.
My fairly firm conviction here is that the central term that we're going to be using, the central theme, is in fact very familiar. One of our problems is it's not going to seem strange to many people at all because of the way that this particular word pervades, runs through our everyday vernacular. And in fact, one of the problems is, if I can just be a little bit blunt about this, we are either disoriented or we are almost conceptually deranged in the way that we use this particular term, in the way that we think about it. And the way that I'm kind of conceiving of this series is that one of the things that we're hoping to do over the following 4 weeks, which I'm kind of imagining really as a single 4-hour conversation that's been artificially broken up over 4 weeks. That's kind of sort of what I'm imagining with four different wonderful guests. But I think one of the goals here that undergirds what we're doing is to take something that is familiar to us, that maybe has become trivialized because of overuse or deranged or unthinking use, and in fact we want to make it strange before handing it back. To say, this is what you've been missing all along. This is what's been neglected.
So I like this formulation. The thing that's interesting about it is the reason we do keep using this term is an inheritance. It's
perfect.
Because
that's
it emerges actually from something that was far more richly understood that has since been forgotten. So all we have now is kind of like the fossil record.
You are doing conceptual archaeology every time you use this term, except in quite technical medical settings.
Yes. Okay, sure.
Every other time, this is either conceptual or etymological archaeology, and you didn't even realize you were doing it.
Shall we lift the veil? Yes. I mean, if you're listening to this on a podcast, look, you've seen the title. It's not a mystery. But on the radio, I'm sure you're on tenterhooks.
All right. One of the many reasons why this topic fits this particular focus of the month is what we try to do during these 4 weeks of Ramadan is to try to strip back the inessential, which is not to say the unimportant. I think that's really crucial. That there are things that those who observe Ramadan go without that are in fact important. The point is they are not the essential things. And one of the problems with some of the habits about the way that we live, whether you're religiously observant or whether you care about the cultivation of the moral life, one of the problems we often run up against is that we prioritize the merely important. And sometimes we neglect or overlook or allow to atrophy that which is truly essential. That which, can I put it this way? I'm adapting a metaphor of Al-Ghazali here. Mm-hmm. But the essential can often cocoon or provide a degree of security for the important.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It enriches the important. It allows us to see in the important that which, you know, does in fact concern us from day to day, but to see it in a different light. Whereas if you strip away the essential, then the merely important can frequently become subject to or fall victim of all sorts of forms of self-deception or hypocrisy or merely utilitarian ends. So one of the things we try to do in Ramadan is to strip away the important, the non-essential, in order to expose that which is essential, that which we should be cultivating, caring for, monitoring, giving the right degree of attention to. Again, this is whether you're religiously observant or not. And the way that we often talk about that which is essential is we refer to this is the heart of it. This is the heart of something. This is the heart of the matter. Let's get to the heart of things. When we use the term heart as a way of signaling the core, the essence, the kernel, that without which the thing would not be the thing, we're getting to one aspect of a very old concept, which regards, and this is something that goes back to the elder cultures of Mesopotamia and Egypt and China. This is a concept that has flown through theological, philosophical, religious traditions of 2 millennia or more, or in fact, 2.5, nearly 3 millennia. This concept of the heart being the originary principle, to use the Greek term that Aristotle would use, the heart is the arche. It's that which is first and primary, that which is primary and that from which everything else that is of importance relates back. So I think what's interesting here, the heart is not the only thing, but it is the fundamental thing to which other aspects, other organs, other faculties of the body, the heart is that to which everything else relates. This is what's sometimes referred to as the cardiocentric vision of the human body. And one of the interesting things about it is that it actually relegates the brain to a secondary role. The heart is that which is primary. The heart is that which receives sense perception. The heart is that which then directs or interprets sense perception and then integrates, unifies the various movements of the body. The brain has a role. Reason has a role. But it all takes place within the confines of the structuring, unifying, receptive, and then directing elements that the heart performs.
It sounds deeply radical when you put it that way. And it might be worth, I suppose, teasing out why that is. And it has to do with a kind of a worldview that privileges this thing we call rationality, but doesn't understand the ways in which that itself is a contestable position. Because when you think about the way you live your life and the things that really matter to you and the things that direct you, actually most of those cannot be reduced, and I use the word reduced deliberately, to rationality. Purely rational forms of politics, of behavior and so on, inevitably end up looking hugely brutal. We see that, for example, in the way that communism expressed itself. This is a political ideology of pure rationality. That's what it is. And yet there is something else that the human being carries with them at all times that make all sorts of, you know, the most important things in life possible. Things like love, for example. Things like the apportionment of value. And that is a thing that stems somehow from intuition. That we just know certain things to be of value, that we know certain things to be true. Without them, art would be impossible. Hmm. Or at the very least, it would be really sterile. It would probably actually just be irrational and therefore of no use. So we live with this at every moment, but because we left behind not the vernacular of the heart, as you point out, but the deeper and richer understanding of what that precisely means, because we left all that behind, we sort of end up having a very, thin, maybe just untheorized or not very well understood notion of what these things are that we're invoking and what they mean actually in our lives. And then that becomes a problem because if we only understand it as a kind of fleeting metaphor, a kind of word you say, then we have no real means of tending to it. Mm. I like this sort of, here we are drawing a distinction between the brain and the heart, I guess. I just want to plant a flag here.
Yeah, good.
That distinction to me is not a distinction between thinking and emotion.
Yeah, precisely right.
So I understand I've just said a bunch of stuff about rationality and there are complications with that that might get fleshed out over the month. But the heart as traditionally conceived in all those ancient civilizations that you're talking about, certainly in the context of religious traditions, certainly in the context of the Islamic tradition, the heart is not merely a thing that feels. It is also a thing that knows. Mm-hmm. And it's quite striking and strikingly pre-modern to come across this and really think about it. But again and again, in these traditions, and I'll anchor myself mostly in the Islamic tradition just because I know it best of the ones that you've mentioned, the heart is the seat of the intellect. The brain exists. The brain has a function. But the heart doesn't merely obey the brain. If you think about the way that the Quranic text talks about it, God doesn't talk about people who don't understand because their brains are infirm. It talks about people whose hearts cannot grasp or who cannot see, whose hearts are too hard or too covered over in order to grasp certain things. In other words, there is an element to human understanding, human experience, even human access to reality that simply can't be reasoned out, but has to be the meeting of a reality with a vessel that is ready to receive it. Mm. And that's a really interesting, quite radical sort of idea. I was, as fate would have it, I just happened to be flicking through a book recently that is all about the heart. It's called Purification of the Heart. It's a translation and then commentary upon a poem written by Imam Ahmed al-Mawlud, who is a Mauritanian scholar. The poem is called Matharat al-Qulub, which is the purification of the heart. And in the introduction, Hamza Yusuf is the person who's translating, and he notes a study that came from some physiologists in the 1970s that found that the brain sent messages to the heart, but the heart didn't automatically obey them. It's really interesting that sometimes the heart would speed up and other times it would slow down. This is me reading now from the book, indicating that the heart itself has its own type of intelligence. The brain receives signals from the heart through the brain's amygdala, thalamus, and cortex. The amygdala relates to emotions, while the cortex or neocortex relates to learning and reasoning. Although this interaction is something that's not fully understood from a physiological point of view, we do know the heart is an extremely sophisticated organ with secrets still veiled from us. And it's just something that feels unthinkable in our public culture, that we could think about the heart this way, not merely as a metaphor for emotion, but as an independent faculty, mm-hmm. as something that knows as well as feels, as something that receives and then reflects truth. And understanding that at its heart, understanding that.
QED.
Yeah. Then ushers in a whole lot of questions then about, well, okay, just as different brains are capable of reasoning with different levels of sophistication and different amounts of accuracy, so too are different hearts. If it's a faculty, so too do different hearts have different capabilities. And this was a huge theme. You mentioned Al-Ghazali earlier on. This was a huge theme for Al-Ghazali, because his whole point was, if the heart is a faculty and it is capable of knowing, then the thing that ensures a heart can know is that it is purified. He uses the analogy of a mirror. Once it's polished and it's glistening, then it will reflect the light that is coming to it. But if it's covered over, encrusted, then it can't be penetrated. It suddenly can't receive information. It can't know things. And so the heart might be something that knows, but just as brains can lead you astray, so too can hearts, if not well tended.
Yeah. Everything you just said, I think, is both wonderful and the perfect platform from which, in many respects, we want to proceed. The one word that you said, though, that I would put a question mark next to is when you referred to the heart as an independent faculty. That I'm just...
Is not it independent that's the problem, or faculty?
Faculty is fine. Independent, I'm not. Because one of the things that I think we come up against, and this is certainly there in Aristotle, in my reading of Al-Ghazali, it's certainly there, and certainly in my reading of the kind of later, both Platonic and post-Platonic traditions, the degree of reciprocity that necessarily exists between these different faculties, the way that they inform one another, diminish one another, enhance one another, so much so that even when there is a certain primacy that might be given to one over the other, call it roughly heart and brain, they do nonetheless work together to a degree where it makes no sense to refer to them independently, in the same way that it makes no sense to refer independently to the different parts that constitute a chair, for instance.
So I understand that point. Would you be more comfortable with prime?
Yeah, sure.
Or seminal?
Sure, sure. But look, let me just pick up the Al-Ghazali point and use a slightly different metaphor that he uses, which I found particularly instructive. I mean, look, I know Aristotle much better than I know Al-Ghazali, but Al-Ghazali was deeply indebted to Aristotle in many crucial respects.
Even while viscerally disagreeing with him.
Of course. But that's all wonderful as well. But I think what's one of the really interesting things that Al-Ghazali does is he draws the connection between the heart and the eye. This is particularly in his work, Marvels of the Heart. So he says, for instance, the eye cannot see in the absence of light. Light doesn't strengthen the eye, but light allows that which the eye does to be done more properly, more perfectly. There are two ways that an eye can cease working. An eye can cease working when it has an internal, call it physiological malfunction, or when the eye is deprived altogether of light, when you're plunged into pitch darkness, for instance. So he draws this really interesting connection between the eye, or most specifically the pupil, as that which must dilate, which must open itself up to the light in order for that light to allow the eye to see and allow then the brain or the body to see what's around it, to see it as it is, and then to navigate one's way in response to it. So what's really curious there, and this takes us all the way down, I think, to Iris Murdoch, really interestingly. So what the heart does is the heart is the medium, according to Al-Ghazali, and again, there are resonances in this in Aristotle too. The heart is the medium whereby the body, the mind, the soul, however you want to put it, whereby the body is exposed to the light that allows us to see and live in and engage with the world. When the eye is closed, becomes full of cataracts, is encrusted in darkness, maybe the eye is exposed to too much light.
Yeah.
So much so that it becomes damaged. He draws the specific connection here to too many stimuli, to too much teaching, so much teaching that one cannot tell the truth from falsity. When the eye is exposed to too much, we do not see as the light would permit us to see. And so in all these ways, the eye as the heart as the medium that is then attentive to light, the eye must be tended to. It must be cared for. It must be taught how to open up and receive, but not open up and receive too much that it becomes damaged. And I think there's something there, Waleed, that's really striking to me. So if you think in terms of the moral philosophical traditions, there is a philosophical tradition, I mean, it's roughly called basically deontology. This is roughly Kantian. This is undergirt by the language of obligation, of accountability, of ought. These are the things, these are the rights, the forms of dignity, the forms of respect that are accorded. These are the things that are, let's just put it this way, rationally available to us.
And which have an independent moral value irrespective of consequence.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. These are things that are an essential part of the moral life. It seems to me that there is no properly moral conception of morality that isn't structured around, that isn't answerable to notions of accountability, of what we ought to do in certain situations, of what people are owed by virtue of their dignity, by virtue of their humanity, by virtue of their creativeness, or whatever. But for morality to be confined to the deontological, call it deontic morality, the language of ought, the language of desert, the language of what is owed, that only gets to one aspect, maybe not even the entire aspect, maybe not even half of the aspect of what is properly constituted as the moral life. There is also a form of non-deontic morality. There is a form of morality that has nothing to do with what I am owed, what I deserve, what is properly coming to me. This is the language that, I mean, when we talk in terms of love, this is what we are really talking about. When we see someone, as Iris Murdoch would put it, justly and lovingly, she immediately underwrites that description as, in other words, seeing them as they are. There is an aspect of the moral life and of our relationship to the world that is only, and by the world here, I mean our relationship to beings within that world, beings with whom we are in moral community. There are things that are accessible to us as part of our moral being in the world that are, if I can just put it this way, incomprehensible to the language of ought and desert. It's not a rose-colored way of seeing the world. It is the world as it is. It is other people as they are. But it's only accessible to us, for want of a better term, through the eyes of love, through the heart. And I think what's really striking here is that to understand the heart as that which must be cultivated, that which must be cared for and permitted to be open, at times to make itself vulnerable to other people. This is what we mean when we say we want to have a heart-to-heart conversation. This is what we mean when we say, I want to express heartfelt remorse. You're saying at a very deep level that goes beyond the mere language of guilt or ought or desert or dignity or respect. I want to expose something about myself and the way that I am exposed to the moral reality of others. The language of love, the language of the heart, it's not a sentimental way of engaging with reality. It answers to an aspect of reality that is there.
And so this is Ibn Arabi's point.
Yes, that's right.
So he would talk about this as when you start to imbibe certain attributes. He focused specifically on the attribute of mercy, compassion, rahma in Arabic, which is probably not captured by those terms fully. But anyway, he says, when one cultivates a heart that is orientated towards that, then suddenly one sees that in the world.
That's right.
And in their relationships with other people. And by that, he doesn't mean they see it as a nice idea. He means they see it as a reality.
Yes, that's right.
They see it as a truth. And so their orientation towards truth is informed by that process. I think this is partly what someone like Al-Ghazali was getting at when he talks about it as a faculty or as a sense. Mm-hmm. He has this really interesting discussion. Because, by the way, he was not a person who parked rationality. We should make that really clear. He was a master logician. He had mastered philosophy. He had done all of that sort of stuff. And he applied that sort of stuff with a razor sharp precision. But his whole point was, that is where that is the faculty or the tool of knowing that is called for. There are other ways in which other moments where a different sense is the only thing that can, you know, you don't look at the stars with a microscope, for example. It just, it's not that microscopes are bad. It's the wrong tool. Yeah, it's the wrong thing for that particular thing. And he makes two really interesting points there. One about rationality, to return to it, which I don't mean to do, is the thing about rationality is that, yes, important, but there's no rational proof for its own sufficiency. So it's a tool, but to say it is the only relevant tool, well, you would need rationally to prove that if that were true. And there is no rational proof for that. You can't prove it on its own terms. You have to appeal to some other thing, probably actually some kind of intuition. But the other analogy he makes with the senses that I think does speak to what you're talking about there is, he says, if you were to tell a human being that had only ever experienced touch, that there was this sense called sound, they would have no, I don't know how you explain it, but anyway, they would have no way of approaching it. If you were to speak to a human being that had never heard of sight and had the other senses, and you tried then to explain what sight was, that would be almost impossible for them to do. So it is, he says, with the senses that are opened up by the heart. Mm. It is when that sense is cultivated that it's, and what are we going to call it? It's epistemological value? That sounds very dry. Where its abilities suddenly start to unfold.
Yeah.
And I think that goes directly back to what you're talking about.
That's right.
There. Yeah.
There is a knowledge of the heart. There are eyes of the heart. There are forms of knowing that are only available to forms of seeing that are cultivated through love. And to simply say that these things are just emotional, these things are merely sentimental, it's to get something, I think, so fundamentally wrong, not just about the nature of human being and reciprocity within the world, but it also provides us, I think, with a very curtailed and, I think, ultimately profoundly deficient concept of morality.
And it means two things. One, that just as other senses can mislead us, so too can this one.
Yeah.
If it is not looked after.
Perfect. Well done.
And second, that just as the other senses can be fragile, you can expose yourself to sound that will damage your hearing or even take it away. The eye is an incredibly fragile thing. Just as that is true, so too is there a fragility in the heart. And if that is not looked after, then, well, who knows what it will start to perceive and what it will think it knows that is not of reality. All right, shall we bring in a guest?
Yes.
You're listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali, my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. Let's get some help, Scott.
Our guest is a moral philosopher that I've been reading for the better part of a decade and a half, possibly more, whose work has meant a great deal to me and has informed many aspects of the show. We finally get to have him on the show. Stephen Darwall is the Andrew Downey Orrick Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. He's the author of a number of landmark works in modern moral philosophy. He's probably best known for The Second Person Standpoint, a book from 2006, but it's one of his most recent works that has really informed the idea of this show. It's called The Heart and Its Attitudes. Stephen, welcome to The Mindfield.
Well, thanks very much, Scott. It's great to be here. Very happy to be invited. I mean, it was a very rich discussion that you guys were laying down. Mostly, I thought what you were saying was just terrific, wonderful, true. The stuff about faculties, the idea of the heart as a faculty that itself knows things. I think it's we who know things through our heart, just as it's we who see through our eyes. It's we who know through our reason. So that's really the only place I'd push back. And I'm really eager to talk about all these things that you mentioned, including R.S. Murdoch. So fire away.
Well, Stephen, let's just pick it up at exactly that point. I mean, I'm inclined to agree with you about faculty. And that's partly, I think, the point that I was trying to make about there being a kind of independent faculty. The relationship among them is such that they necessarily need to be complementary to one another. It then leads to a kind of diminishment of the whole. But let's just pick up this precise idea about the heart itself. I mean, this is a weird topic for moral philosophers to deal with. Why, why did you decide to do what many analytic philosophers would just dismiss as merely a metaphor?
Yeah. Well, it took a change in my life to get me interested in this and thinking about it, involving relationships with people who are very dear to me, and my sort of blundering through them in various ways that are not unusual for philosophers. I mean, philosophers are trained to respond to the content of what someone says rather than the feelings behind it. And so, you know, I'm 79 years old, and I've had a lot of experience, and a lot of it has been sort of blundering in my philosophical way as a reasoner. I mean, my first book was called Impartial Reason, and you can't get any more or less about the heart than that. So I just wanted to understand more about this incredibly important dimension of human life. So I'm a philosopher, and so I didn't think about the heart with my heart. I thought about the heart with my head. So philosophers, as my wife Laura are fond to point out, are typically head people rather than heart people. And so I thought, well, okay, I can use my head to understand the heart. I mean, one reason philosophers don't talk about it is because it's a metaphor. The only actual heart is an organ that's, you know, physical and physiological in its nature. What I mean by the heart is a syndrome of various kinds of emotional susceptibilities and vulnerabilities, that with which we are vulnerable to one another and can connect with one another in heartfelt relation. And that's what I tried to figure out. So I contrast it with what I call attitudes of the will. So as you pointed out, my first book, The Second Person Standpoint, the subtitle was Morality, Respect, and Accountability. That's all on the deontic side. Of course, there's been a lot of pushback about that, that being the only dimension. So care ethics, for example, that came in with feminist moral philosophy in, like, especially the 1980s and on. That's one kind of pushback, but I think even that doesn't get quite to the heart of connection, the way in which we are able to connect with one another and share emotional lives. And so that's what I wanted to understand.
I think that's very helpful. The idea of the heart as naming a kind of syndrome. I know that Waleed bristles a little bit at the idea of emotions being a syndrome of emotions, but I think the way that you qualify it as emotional capabilities or susceptibilities, the ability to be open, and the degree to which this is undergirt by vulnerability. Can I just pick up on this point? Because I think this is also going to resonate deeply with what Waleed just mentioned before. However else we understand the moral language concerning the heart, there is a degree to which it is peculiarly, interpersonally, and morally vulnerable. I mean, one of the things that we often say is you cannot demand forgiveness. Forgiveness must be offered or else it's not forgiveness. Yeah. The best that can be done is to make oneself such in one's obvious remorse, maybe in the way that you've changed your life, maybe in the way that you've adopted a different way of being or relating to that person, the best you can do is to hold out, at best, an invitation, or maybe simply a plea. Is there something about the way that I've opened myself up to you relationally that allows you to respond to me, to reciprocate to me by means of forgiveness? But there is a vulnerability in that exchange, because not only is the original act of, you know, in the way that I'm wanting to try to make amends, show remorse, that can't be guaranteed that it's ever going to be thoroughgoing enough, that the change has been radical enough. But the invitation can itself be turned down. That means that everything involving the heart can in fact go wrong in some way, unless it's treated with particular care and reciprocal response.
Yeah. So I make a couple of distinctions that are relevant to this. One is between what I call deontic forgiveness and heartfelt forgiveness. I'll say what those are in a moment. And the other is between guilt, which is a deontic attitude, and remorse, which isn't. The distinction in the latter distinction is between feeling responsible for something and wanting to make amends and hold yourself accountable for what you did, acknowledge the wrongdoing, and so on. That's guilt. Remorse is a kind of sorrow about having caused someone distress or even just inconvenience or having hurt them in some way. So it's non-deontic. It's an attitude of the heart in my terms. This difference between deontic forgiveness and heartfelt forgiveness, neither of these can be required. Both have to be requested. But you can imagine cases where someone asks for forgiveness, the person of whom they ask it accepts that the other person has held themselves accountable, you know, in every way they could. They've taken responsibility for the wrongdoing and so on. And yet they've been so hurt, the person who's been wronged has been so hurt that they can't accept them back into their hearts. That's heartfelt forgiveness. If they could, if they could be really reconciled, if they could embrace, then that would be heartfelt forgiveness. So these are two registers, if you like, of emotional attitudes. One is deontic, and it presupposes a kind of mutual accountability to one another. And the other is non-deontic, and it's not a matter of the will. It's a matter of the heart, and it's mutual heartfelt connection. So both of these attitudes, what I call attitudes of the will, on the one hand, respect, guilt, blame, and so on, all about deontic morality. And the heartfelt, these are called reactive attitudes after an article by P.S. Strawson called Freedom and Resentment. Those are hankering after, they involve an invitation, never a demand, an invitation for heartfelt connection. And both of them come with an RSVP. That is, they're both in what I call the second person standpoint, where there's an implicit address of the other. And you're hoping, in the case of the heartfelt ones, that it'll be responded to, accepted and responded to.
These are, I think, really wonderful distinctions, actually, Stephen, and really helpful ones. What I hear as you talk there about this process of remorse, forgiveness, guilt, so on, is that if we talk about remorse and then forgiveness, heartfelt forgiveness, these are also things that reflect then the states of the hearts that are in question. Mm. And those states are changeable, to foreshadow a theme that I think we'll end up talking about later in the series. So it may well be that someone finds someone else really difficult to forgive in their heart. But that also depends on the capacity of the heart.
Yeah.
There are people whose hearts are in such a state as their capacity to forgive is expansive.
Yeah, it's true.
And that is not something that is merely a matter of their DNA or something like that, at least not in the way that traditional philosophers and theologians would have thought about the heart. It is a thing that is cultivated in the same way that we understand how our muscles get cultivated by work, right? We do things and then their capacity increases and so on. So this is why in religion, the heart is essential. It is paramount. It is the thing you are seeking to purify if your religion is worthy of the name. But it is always attended to by certain practices. It's not just left on your own. Like if you just, just have a softer heart or just have a more expensive. No.
Yeah.
It's the result of a certain cultivation. The distinction you draw, I think, between remorse and guilt is a really useful one. And in some ways, it comes back to this point I was trying to make before about the faculty of knowing. And I do take your point about does the heart know? But that raises the question, if we know not the heart, who exactly are we? And that's another series. But the thing that's interesting about that is guilt is in some ways the rational registering of a wrong. I can reason out that I've done something wrong. I feel guilty about that. I have guilt about that. Remorse is where you are confronted with the reality of it.
Yeah.
Reality is not the same. Is this too fine a distinction? Reality and truth are not necessarily this. I'm talking about the full-bodied, fully imbued with the spirit of something, the reality of the wrongdoing. That can't be grasped intellectually by definition. It's a different thing. It has to be felt. It can only be felt. And that feeling is not a mere emotion. That feeling is a grasping of something real.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I wonder if that's helping tease out the sort of point I'm trying to make.
Yeah. So I'd make another distinction. So guilt is an emotion, just as remorse is an emotion. Both of them involve grasping something. I think in the case of guilt, what gets grasped is the wrongness of a certain bit of conduct, how culpable one's conduct is. In the case of remorse, what you grasp is not about it's not about the conduct. It's about what happened to that person. What, in virtue of what you did, how that person was damaged or hurt or even just inconvenienced. So in both cases, we learn something. And let me just say, also agree with you that this is a matter of cultivation. It's not, forgiveness is in the gift of the wronged. But I don't think there's any obligation to cultivate yourself, to cultivate love or to cultivate a forgiving spirit. But it certainly is good for everybody if one does. I mean, that's the message, I guess, of Christianity. Forgive your enemies. That's partly for your enemies' sake, but that's also for your sake. James Baldwin is just great on this. But yeah, so I think this is all about, they're both all about grasping truths. It's just a different truth. So the first truth with guilt is the wrongness and culpability of what one did. And the truth in the case of remorse is the damage, or as Baldwin says in this marvelous debate with William F. Buckley, which you can, 1965 Cambridge debate, if you haven't seen it, Google that, you'll find it. Anyway, it's the expense in emotional terms, especially the heart expense of, in this case, white supremacy.
This is The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali's my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. The voice you just heard there belongs to Stephen Darwell, who's professor of philosophy at Yale University, as we talk about the heart. Maybe could I just extend it slightly further, Stephen? I don't know that remorse does have to be connected to the damage that is done. I think grasping that damage, grasping the reality of it, certainly helps and is important. But actually, I think you can be remorseful about something that did no damage that you can perceive, simply because you understand the weight of the transgression. And you might go, that was bad. I might have just gotten away with it in the sense that it didn't do the thing that it could have done. Or maybe this is bad in and of itself, irrespective of what the consequences are. That there's a disease there that I've recognized now. In other words, I mean, I take your point, it's not deontic. But neither is it merely consequentialist. I think this is what I'm trying to get to when I'm saying it's about grasping a reality.
Yeah, so I hear what you're saying. I think we don't really disagree in substance. I think it's more a verbal dispute in the sense that, well, here's why I say that. So the etymology of remorse is connected to sorrow, as in I'm sorry. Sorrow is an attitude of the heart. I'm sorry that I feel sad for what you've had to endure. That's not about the act done. It's about what it meant. And I agree with you, of course, is that you can feel remorse even if it didn't actually damage anyone. Even in those cases, I think it puts you at risk. Other person was put in harm's way, even if, lucky you got away with it in the sense that they didn't actually get hurt. But yeah, so I bet, with more time, we could come to an agreement on this one.
I want to pick up a wonderful invitation, Stephen, that you just provided with the reference to James Baldwin. I mean, Baldwin is just a fascinating character as a character who both evokes love, who invites readers to respond to him with love, but also uses love as part of his own rhetorical appeal and as part of a vernacular, not as a performance, but as a mode of appeal that is integral to what it is that he is hoping for, the idea of a knitted together or mutually responsive community. We've been talking so far about, for want of a better term, the second person standpoint, second person moral relations. So heart to heart, one person's heart responding to another person's moral reality. We've been talking so far about a kind of exchange that takes place between persons and the type of exchange that may be peculiar to or inherent to that exchange. There can be something else, though, that's going on. And to my mind, the example of James Baldwin engaged in 1965 in the Cambridgean debate with William F. Buckley is a prime example of this. Baldwin appealed overtly. I mean, he placed himself on the line. He used first-person terms as a way of gathering together a vast experience and saying, this is not something you can abstract your way out of.
Right.
What he's then doing there is he's inviting supposedly detached listeners into a kind of second-person appeal. I'm speaking to you. Okay, so there's that. But then what I'm wondering is, where do we fit in? Where does an audience fit in? Because to some extent, of course, we're invited into that same reckoning. But we're also spectators, especially when you reach the final moment where Baldwin's act, I mean, if we were using a term of Stanley Cavell's here, we would say that what he displayed was a passionate utterance.
Yeah.
He was placing himself on the line and inviting a kind of double or nothing response.
Yeah.
So when we then watch the participants in those who are observing this debate leap to their feet and engage in a heartfelt response, there is a transformation that takes place of the way that we see Baldwin himself. I mean, there's something here about his diminution of stature. There's something about the openness and vulnerability of his face. In other words, my point here is, when someone who has a particular capability or capacity of heart responds in a heartfelt way to the damage that's been done to another person, especially, say, another person who is characteristically, habitually, politically, societally treated as being of no account or not being worthy of respect, regard, much less love. Yeah. When someone who has that capacity of heart responds to them in a heartfelt way, and here I'm shifting the vernacular a little bit from Baldwin to Iris Murdoch, although I think it fits, it's almost as if their loving attention on this person suddenly elevates, transforms, transmutes them into an appropriate or proper object of love. There is something, in other words, about the heartfelt response that takes place between people that can then have an illuminating effect for people all around. It's almost as if the exchange between the two, the reciprocity, the heartfelt response, the heart to heart, it's almost as if it transforms their moral status into someone who is worthy of love and therefore worthy of and should properly receive my love, my loving attention.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's great. Several thoughts. We, the audience of the videotape or the film, are not the same as the audience who heard the speech directly in the hall. Baldwin makes himself vulnerable. At some points, he gets quite angry. But I don't think one of the things I argue is that the anger is not indignation and blaming anger. It's hurt anger. It's personal anger. It's anger when the heart has been hurt. So anger, I think of not as an attitude of the heart, but as a protector attitude, an attitude and a display of anger that raises the stakes. So he makes himself vulnerable, but he puts us in a vulnerable position as well, because, wait a minute, this guy's getting angry at me. Why? What did I do? You know, but we find ourselves, as you say, transformed by what he does and what he says and by just his evident goodness and vulnerability. And vulnerability invites vulnerability. You know, people are never so... Nothing deals with people's defensiveness better than a defenseless child that who puts us at our ease. So Kant has this wonderful line in the Critique of Practical Reason: before a common, humble, upright man, actually there's two parts to it. He says, if I'm walking past such a person, I may still walk proudly by and sort of implicitly express my higher status. But at the same time, I'm moved by his humility to humble myself and have respect for him. So I think when people don't make demands of us and put themselves in our hands as we are in their hands, you get a reciprocity, a transfer. And in the end, it's a transfer of love. It's the passing of love back and forth. I wouldn't say that they become worthy of love. I'd say we're all worthy of love, whatever. Any being who has the capacity to respond to love with love is worthy of love. but we see them for the first time in a loving way.
That's right.
And it enlivens our love. And so now we've got heartfelt connection. We've got love going back and forth.
Can I put something to you then, Waleed? Mm-hmm. That one of the things that I think we've mistaken, if we think of, for instance, the saints, people who have cultivated that peculiar capacity of large-heartedness, of openness to, say, divine light. When we think of the saints as moral exemplars in the sense that we're supposed to look at them with awe and wonder at how it is they're able to do what they do, we're either missing the main part of the story or we're missing something fundamental, which is part of what it means for those with that large capacity, that large heart capacity, part of what it means for them to have that capacity is for us then to see others, for us then to see the world through the light that their activities, their generosity, their sanctity even throws upon the world.
Yeah, and this is why I think in religious traditions, we've been speaking about this throughout this show at least as a relational, horizontal sort of a thing. Any religious tradition that's talking about the heart is talking about it also, and I would say primarily, as a vertical thing. Mm. So the point of the saints is not that they just happen to be people who have these expansive hearts. It's that the expanse of their hearts is receiving, you just said, divine light and reflecting it out. It is what their hearts are capable of knowing of the divine that then radiates. That conceivably is open to anyone. Yes. Which is part of the point about cultivation, right? That's right. Not just they were miraculous beings that happened to behave in this way and have this. No, there's a process there. And to go back to Al-Ghazali, he puts it forward as a science. It is falsifiable. This is what you do. These are the steps you take. This is the path you walk. That is the end result. And anyone who walks it will experience it if they walk it properly. So it's a different sort of a way of understanding it, I think.
This is, by the way, why Kierkegaard was so suspicious of responding to saints with admiration. Well, not admiration. They want you to go and do likewise.
Yeah. What they're doing is it's a signpost. They're holding up a signpost. They're not the icon themselves. That's the point. I just think everything I've heard in the last little bit, it really brings to mind something we haven't discussed, but I think it explains it. And that is the way in which persuasion actually works in the world. Yeah. That we think about, especially in a democracy, we seem to think that persuasion works by being able to win arguments and convince people. Okay, there's an element to which that happens, but actually it's a tiny element. People are mostly persuaded by others' states. There is some way in which the heart inclines towards something, some idea, someone, because it is reflecting something to them. And we've spoken about that in the context of vulnerability. Absolutely, that's true. But it's not just the vulnerability per se, I think. It's also what that vulnerability reveals about the heart behind it.
Yeah.
There's something about hearts talking and persuading one another, that is, I think, far more a description of human beings and what human beings respond to than, you know, brains duking it out.
Could I just pick up something? Yeah, that you folks were saying that I completely agree with, and I think it can be put in a deontic key and it can be put in a heartfelt key. So Kant, in that passage I was talking about, is making the point that this is not an especially virtuous person. This is an upright person. That is, this person does simply do their duty in a way that everyone can do their duty. So, and similarly, in the heartfelt side, I think the message there is, as you were saying, Waleed, anybody can cultivate the heart. It's not an esoteric faculty. It's something that we all have. So there's something, I think, wonderfully sort of democratic and egalitarian about this way of seeing things.
What a way to end, Stephen. Thank you. It's been, and also what a way to begin. You've done both. Really, really great to speak to you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful for me.
Stephen Darwell, Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. He's the author, most relevantly for this show anyway, of The Heart and Its Attitudes, setting up our Ramadan series, which is focusing on, well, I suppose we'll call it Matters of the Heart, shall we? We'll see. Scott and I will workshop that, and we'll be back next week. You can listen to The Mindfit, of course, on Radio National, as you may be doing right now, but anytime in the meantime on ABC Listen. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.